Latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us, free of corporate influence. Last year, the big headline to come out of the COP28 conference held in Dubai was the news that an agreement had been made amongst participating countries to transition away from fossil fuels. With Canada being the fourth largest oil producer in the world and the fifth largest producer of natural gas, where does this leave us? And what are we expecting to see come out of the upcoming COP29 conference in November? Today, Andrianne Brazo from the David Suzuki Foundation sits down with Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to talk about COP29, the work the foundation does to research and report on climate progress and regress, and how Canadians can participate in climate action. Here are Seabrook and Brazo in conversation. Take a listen.
Andrianne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
First, tell our audience a little bit about who you are and what you do at the David Suzuki Foundation.
I'm a senior policy analyst based in Quebec. So I'm in charge of the public policy work that we do in the province. I also connect with the rest of the team that's elsewhere in Canada. So we have offices in Montreal, in Toronto, and in Vancouver. Our work really focuses on climate, but we also have a lot of projects in biodiversity as well. And we do all kinds of work in environment, which includes research, policy analysis, campaigning, education, and many more things.
Climate and climate coverage is a very important aspect of the work we do here at Rabble. David Suzuki, we publish his column on a weekly basis every Wednesday. And obviously, you know, in the day and age we're living in, it's becoming harder and harder to ignore the extreme weather events that are happening around us. And of course, they're even more top of mind around this time of year as we approach the annual conferences of the parties, the UN meetings to discuss biodiversity and whether or not the parties signed on to the Paris Climate Agreement are reaching their goals. Can you tell us a little bit about your knowledge and expertise with what are known as the COP conferences?
Absolutely. So the COP conferences are part of the climate COPs are part of the UNFCCC, which is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was adopted in 1992. And ever since 1995, countries meet every year under this framework to discuss ways to increase climate action. Mostly first on mitigation, but as the years progress and as we see the impacts of climate change, it's getting more and more real that we also need to tackle adaptation. And now we're even one step further. There's also the issue of loss and damage, which are the irreversible impacts of climate change. So once you can't adapt, you are facing loss and damage. And since the last couple of COPs, we've seen a lot of progress on that front. So it's a good thing for climate justice, even though there is still a lot of work to do to make sure that the Global South, which suffers the impacts of the climate crisis, despite the fact that they're not contributing to it. So it's a good thing for the Global South to see that there is now a loss and damage fund, which is now being negotiated in terms of its operationalization. So who's going to put money in there? How are we going to distribute the money? I guess one example that we can take, that we can use is the small islands in the Pacific, which are unfortunately slowly disappearing under the water. These countries, these communities are facing a loss in culture, a loss in, like, it's their historical background that's being threatened. And they are asking for compensation. And that's what this year is going to be a lot about. In fact, a big, big issue that we are going to be negotiating this year, that countries are going to be negotiating, is the NCQG. There are a lot of acronyms in the world of climate change negotiations. So it's the new collective quantified goal, but I'm going to explain what that is. So basically, mm-hmm. It's the new goal that we are going to set the new finance goal, the yearly target that we want to meet in terms of money to support mitigation, adaptation, and loss and damage in developing countries. So far, the previous goal that countries had set in 2010 was $100 billion a year by 2020, and it still has not been met. But now we're in this new process where we're trying to set a new yearly target, and countries like Canada, like the US, are advocating for other sources of funding that are not just developed countries. So they're asking for banks and for the finance world, the private sector, basically, to contribute a lot more to the fund. And I'll just give you an image about the amount. Basically, the Climate Action Network International, which is the organization that brings together all of the NGOs, the environmental NGOs, under the UNFCCC, have been saying that the amount should be of $1 trillion per year. So it's absolutely astounding as a number. And it's going to be interesting, probably very frustrating for environmental NGOs this year to see how the negotiations turn out on that issue. I want to be optimistic, but I don't think that this year will actually be able to lend those. There is a lot of doubt around whether we're going to be able to settle on a yearly amount or not.
Now, I'm glad that you brought that up, and you've attended COP conferences in the past. I was just wondering, from your perspective, can you explain to our audience a little bit about how they work whenever the meetings are going on? And do you feel that they are effective if, you know, like you just said, they aren't necessarily meeting the goals that they've even set out for themselves in the past, like the 2010 goal of $100 billion a year?
So the way that it works is that ever since the Paris Agreement was adopted, we have the shared objective of maintaining global warming under 1.5 degree by the end of the century. And to do that, we need countries to continuously increase their commitment. And what that does is that technically, when you sign the Paris Agreement, you can never, no matter who is, which party is in power at the national level, you cannot submit any commitment that is weaker than the previous one. So that goes for money, but that also goes for the climate plan that you submit, for the targets that you set for yourself. And that is unfortunately why countries like the US have withdrawn in the past. And to answer your question, the great weakness, which is also a strength, it depends how you see it, about the Paris Agreement, is that nothing really happens if you don't do your part, or if you don't really respect what you said you would do. So as I said, the previous goal of $100 billion a year has not been met yet. And here we are still negotiating at COPs, and everything is going as usual, unfortunately. So there's not really any kind of strong accountability.
Speaking of accountability, and speaking of the role of the participants at COP, I wanted to talk a little bit about Canada's role and Canada's participation. You know, like any, you know, if you're in school, your group projects, sometimes there are group members of your project who are real go-getters. Sometimes there are others who are letting others do the work. So what has Canada's role been in recent years at COP? Are we very eager to see climate solutions be achieved, or are we maybe sort of trying to pull the reins back a little bit and maybe not contributing as much as we might be able to?
Well, Canada is an interesting character in the climate negotiations. On the one hand, they are very strong advocates for everything that touches human rights, women's rights, even just transition for workers on the global stage. But then we can see that there is a big gap with what's really happening in Canada. Canada is an oil state, and that is a fact. And they kind of try to hide that reality when they are in the negotiations, letting countries who are more vocal on oil and gas take the role of the bad cop or the bad guy. So they show up as leaders, but when we look at our numbers, we know that we're not on the right track, that we're not doing our fair share of the global effort, that we have never reached a single one of our climate targets. So there is an inconsistency in what's being said and what's being brought on the international stage and what's really happening at home.
Now, something else that you had mentioned in your answer there that I'm really glad you brought up, because Rabble and our readers and our listeners are also very passionate about women's rights and workers' rights. How do women's rights and workers' rights fit into the discussion around climate change, and how are they being discussed and handled at COP?
Well, what's really interesting in the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, just wanted to repeat it so it's clear, it's a well-defined acronym. There are civil society groups have advocated historically to have a say in what's being negotiated. So there are 9 constituencies that have a voice that can actually speak during the negotiation sessions. And among those groups, we have women, we have farmers, we have workers, we have environmental NGOs, we have even youth organizations. There's also the subnational group of cities and provinces like Quebec or BC. So there's a bunch of them, and they have been recognized as actors, as stakeholders in the negotiations throughout time. I think that the last group that joined, if I remember correctly, is the Indigenous group, which was in 2008 or 9.
Okay, and you had mentioned earlier that you expect one of the big items to come out of this year's COPs would be another demand for increase of funding for compensation to countries in the global south who are affected by extreme weather events. Are there any other issues or topics at this year's COP, whether the biodiversity one, which is currently going on in Cali, Colombia, or the COP29, which will be happening later in the year, focused on the Paris Climate Agreement? Are there any other issues that you expect or you're looking for to come out of these conferences this year?
Absolutely. There are always many things that are being negotiated, and actually, throughout time, there are more and more negotiating tracks that appear. Like I was saying earlier, the loss and damage one wasn't there in the past. So it's a whole new branch that was added through time. Just like just transition is also an issue that's becoming more and more incorporated in the negotiation processes. So what we're going to be following this year is also the follow-up to last year's historical agreement in the final text, we, for the first time, mentioned what we needed to leave behind in order to achieve the 1.5 degree limit. And that is transitioning away from fossil fuels. And we also agreed to triple renewable energy and double energy efficiency by 2030. So these three things are going to be discussed in more details this year. How are we going to transition away from fossil fuels, hence the need for the just transition track? So now that we've really addressed the issue, it took 28 COPs to get there. Now that we've named it, we can really dig into the solutions and address all of the collaterals that will happen, the workers that will be impacted and all of that. And we're also going to be preparing for the next round of climate plans, or what we call in the UNFCCC world, the NDCs, the nationally determined contributions. So countries are going to start submitting their climate target for 2035. And next year at COP30 in Brazil, they will have to submit their new 5-year plan, and we'll be looking out for Canada's new target this year for sure, and also Canada's plan next year. And I guess quickly, another big issue will be the global goal on adaptation, because right now we're trying to negotiate the equivalent of the 1.5 degree in terms of mitigation and what it could look like as a collective target for adaptation. But the issue with that is that adaptation means something different everywhere, while for mitigation, we have a number, we have a clear number. So it's easy to adjust to it. And so the adoption of a global goal on adaptation is going to be trickier. The negotiations have already been undergoing for 2-3 years, and we'll see if we're able to land on it on the global goal this year.
Okay. And, you know, obviously, a lot of these issues and how Canada represents itself at the COP conferences is connected with politics. And, you know, we have many elections coming up across the country at the provincial level. In BC, it's a very close election between the BC NDP and an election denier in the BC Conservatives. We have a federal election coming up in the next year with the Conservatives again looking like they may win. Oil companies have such a strong influence in our politics, thanks to their vast amounts of money and resources. How can individuals let their elected officials know that they feel that climate is important? How can they lobby them? How can they encourage them that we're properly represented at conferences like COP?
Well, they should write to their MPs, whether it's on social media or through the official ways, by email, by phone also. There are multiple ways to make it known. The David Suzuki Foundation also has a campaign that's called Fossil Fuels Exposed that people can support online. And there are many other initiatives by many other organizations. There is a real issue with the big presence of oil and gas industry at COPs, and they are even part of the Canadian delegation. So that's an issue. I'm just going to compare it to the World Health Organization summits, where they don't allow tobacco companies, who cause the main issues, the main problems, to be there and to participate in the discussion. So it is very much time that the UNFCCC process also does the same, in my opinion, and in a lot of people's opinion as well.
Now, just sticking on the individual level, you know, seeing how many extreme weather events, how they're becoming so frequent, seeing, you know, COPs sometimes, they feel like the change is incremental. The goals, like you stated earlier, are not necessarily being met. How can individuals who are maybe feeling pessimistic about the future of the climate, what can they do to maybe feel like they're being more active and participating in solutions?
The first thing that people should do to make a difference is voting for parties who want to protect the environment and fight against climate change. The policy changes that need to be done, once they're done, take time before we feel the measures. So it's important that we don't delay them, and that we really vote for parties that will tackle climate issues as a priority. And I will also add that right now, with current polls, we see that the issues that are top of mind are inflation, are housing, and that the environment and climate come third or fourth. But we need to remember that everything is connected, and that the more we wait for strong climate action, and the more we wait before reaching our net zero goal, the more it impacts our society, the more it makes prices increase because climate change impacts the food supply chains. It has all the extreme weather events that are happening, that's also making living more costly. So it really should be top of mind for everyone to secure our future, even in the near future. I'm not talking in the long term. So I think voting is the most powerful thing people can do. But other than that, to counter eco-anxiety, I would suggest getting involved in whatever organization that works on an issue that you're passionate about. Giving some of your time, that's a good way of being less overwhelmed by all the bad news that we receive on a daily basis.
Getting involved is very important, and we love the work that the David Suzuki Foundation does. And if people listening want to support the great work that you and your colleagues are doing at the David Suzuki Foundation, is there a way for them to do that?
Yes, they can go on our website and they can contribute. They can subscribe to our mailing list, our newsletter, and receive opportunities for engagement. They can also donate money when that's possible. They can contribute to all of our actions. That's a free way to get engaged. So that means sometimes sending emails to MPs or signing petitions and all kinds of things that, as we've seen in the past, have an impact and work when we have a government that's willing to listen to the population.
Andrianne Brazo, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
That was Andrianne Brazo from the David Suzuki Foundation and Rabble editor Nick Seabrook in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Andrianne and Nick. Listeners, to support the work the David Suzuki Foundation does, please visit davidsuzuki.org. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Back to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in labor news. Unions representing federal employees are calling for a parliamentary investigation of the Treasury Board's return to office mandate. Earlier this fall, the Treasury Board, which oversees the federal public service, mandated that federal employees had to return to the office 3 days a week. Like many other workers, federal employees were shifted to a remote work environment during the COVID-19 pandemic. According to both the Public Service Alliance of Canada and the Canadian Association of Professional Employees, the Treasury Board is forcing a one-size-fits-all solution on their members, a decision that is not supported by the Treasury Board's own research. According to the Treasury Board's research, remote work can improve job satisfaction, work-life balance, general well-being, and efficiency. Remote work also has benefits for employers, who can reduce costs by reducing the need for offices while also expanding the pool of potential employees. Both of the unions representing federal employees are calling on the House of Commons Standing Committee on Government Operations and Estimates to investigate the Treasury Board's three-day-a-week in-office mandate and how that was implemented. Staying in labor news, Employment and Development Services Canada hosted a workforce summit last week in Montreal. The goal of the summit was to address challenges and opportunities for Canada's labor market in the 21st century. Challenges facing the labor market are a shortage of workers, the impending retirement of many older workers, and a lack of equitable access to the labor market for Indigenous workers and other communities. To address these challenges, Federal Employment Minister Randy Boisneau announced a fund to retrain workers who are having difficulties entering or staying in the labor market. The Forum of Labor Market Ministers, an organization representing provincial labor and employment ministers, boycotted the meeting, as they said that they were not properly consulted about the summit and said that any labor market solutions must be done with the support of the provinces. In economic news, in an op-ed on Rabble, John Cartwright explains that investment will solve Canada's affordability crisis, not austerity and tax cuts for the rich. Cartwright explains that the COVID-19 pandemic showed that national solutions require civility and cooperation. That cooperation continued at the federal level, says Cartwright, pointing to the partnership between the Liberals and the NDP that achieved important legislation like a national dental care and national pharmacare plan. By contrast, the Conservatives offer cuts and division. Explaining the Conservative attitude, Cartwright writes, quote, "They offer empty promises and seek to distract us by creating enemies. Instead of solving people's real problems, they want to divide our communities, undermine our democracy, and weaken the public service that we rely on. Instead of long-term solutions, they offer tax cuts. But tax cuts won't shorten the wait times in the emergency room, won't help kids succeed in school, and won't help care for an aging parent." End quote. In environmental news, Canadian Biotechnology Action Network is warning about a global effort by pesticide companies to suppress those voices that speak out against their products. According to the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network, VFluence, a PR firm based in the U.S., is actively working to suppress those who speak out against the use of pesticides and provide governments with propaganda that discourages banning pesticide use. The propaganda includes hit pieces on anti-pesticide advocates and shows that VFluence is actively engaged in collecting information on activists, some of which is private in nature. This campaign to suppress anti-pesticide activism is being coordinated by Jay Byrne, a former communications executive with Monsanto, one of the largest pesticide companies in the world. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki warns about the environmental cost that war has on our planet. With major conflicts ongoing in Ukraine, Africa, and the Middle East, Suzuki explains that not only do bullets and bombs destroy trees, landscapes, and kill everything within a war zone, they also have severe negative long-term effects on the environment as well. A forest destroyed in a few days of fighting will take decades to grow back. Bombing kills animals and disrupts the natural ecosystem. Furthermore, there are also pollutants that are created by military vehicles and other operations. The US military, for example, is one of the largest greenhouse gas emitters in the world. Suzuki says there must be an end to militarism for the sake of the world's long-term stability. And as always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Stay, donate. Fund Drive is here and we need you, radio's best friend, along the way. Donate now at cgsffunddrive.ca or text DONATE to 778-782-2573 and be radio's best friend.
You're listening